show. I'm Jennifer Dudley.
And I'm Abby Jorgensen. And this is Fascinating Ordinary, where we get curious about everyday things that are actually amazing.
We're glad you're here with us. Abby, which rabbit hole are we going down today?
So today, we're going down a rabbit hole that involves the most important arts and crafts project of your life, modified sweat glands, and the episode of Friends where Monica tries to replicate Phoebe's grandmother's cookies. Do you know which one I'm talking
about? Yeah, of course
yes,
I do.
That
Deluce,
one.
Sorry, spoiler alert.
Yep.
Oh, man. Okay.
Nizla Toulouse.
Yeah.
And his famous cookies. Yeah. So, with that said, welcome to our two-episode journey through the curious and often stressful everyday act of feeding children.
What Abby's going to get into here is that we have a two-parter planned for this.
Yep.
Part one is feeding children who eat milk.
Not even really that. I may have misinterpreted the prompt if that's what I was supposed to do.
That's
but
all right.
I was planning to cover feeding humans from their very beginning until their first birthday.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. That's folks, you're getting more than we bargained for. This is great. And then in part two, I will cover everything from, okay, your child is eating solid foods. Up to stuff that has ramifications for adulthood, but, you know, I'm not going to talk about feeding adults. Your adult children are off the table.
That's a good pun. I appreciate that. There we go. So feeding very small humans is a thing that Jennifer and I have both done recently. My most recent was this morning. I don't know about yours. But
I mean, my child ate today. He did eat.
But even if you're not a parent and if you're not actively feeding small children, I think it's really interesting to learn about the world of feeding small children, because there are so many implications of this for our entire society. It really matters to you how the kid next door or the kid down the street is eating and what they're eating and how they're going to be as a member of society because of that, which is obviously why it matters to people when we have children who are facing malnourishment or starvation or things like this. So we're going to be looking at this really important societal topic, but I'm sure there'll be a few individual tips and tricks for parents as well.
I would add, of course, every single person who's listening to this has been fed as a newborn, an infant, etc., that it's relevant to everybody, or has at one point been relevant to everybody, even if they don't have kids right now or aren't feeding little kids right now or don't plan to anytime soon.
Yep. So with that in mind, let's talk about human development, because that is where I want to start this. So if you don't know this about me already, I am a pregnancy, fetal development, birth, labor, delivery, postpartum nerd. And this is really exciting for me to get to, like, quiz you, Jennifer. So here you go. You ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to say words and ask you to define them.
Okay.
And if you don't know what they mean, just, like, make it up.
Okay.
Just take your best, best guess. Right. Okay? Here we go. All right. Infant.
A baby. Just, like, before a year old.
Right? Okay. Yeah. All right. Newborn.
First 6 weeks, 8 weeks, somewhere in there.
Okay. I'm not going to tell you if you're right or not yet.
Oh, good. Okay.
You're, like, looking at me waiting for approval, but I'm not telling you. Okay. Fetus.
Not out of the womb yet.
Okay. Embryo.
Gosh, at what point does an embryo become a fetus?
We'll get there.
A collection of cells?
Okay. Zygote.
Two cells specifically.
Okay. All right. So zygote, embryo, fetus, newborn, infant are all stages of development.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically today we're talking about human development. So these are very similar, analogous to like toddler, preschooler, adolescent, adult, right? These are terms that we use to denote the stage at which a particular human is. And what's really fascinating about this is that the ways we eat food are very different when we're a toddler versus an adult, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if we're, say, a zygote versus a fetus or things like that, which I'm about to get into. So any questions before we jump into what those terms are and how we eat at each of those terms?
No, I'm excited. Let's
okay, here we go. So to explain the stages of human development, I want to introduce you to an imaginary, very, very small human whose name is Olivia, because that is the number one most common name in 2022 when we're recording this episode.
All
is
right.
Olivia. So that's what I'm going with. Olivia just got conceived. Congratulations to Olivia. So a human egg and a human sperm just came together to create her. That's the two cells that you talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
So she is called a human zygote.
Okay.
a zygote is just like a generic term. Like you can have puppy zygotes or, well, dog zygotes or something, yeah. Right? But specifically we're talking about humans today, so that's what we're focusing on. Human zygotes, like Olivia, typically move through the fallopian tube and into the uterus. If these are terms you don't know about, I would love to share more with you about them, but we're not going to focus on them at the moment, except that Jennifer is going to ask me a question.
I guess I'm surprised. I always thought that the daddy sperm and the mommy egg met in the uterus, not in the fallopian tube.
No, they meet in the fallopian tube. Oh, so the sperm goes through the uterus, up through the fallopian tube, and meet the egg somewhere in the fallopian tube.
All right. I mean, I have a child. You'd think I would be up on how he got here.
You can have a child without knowing about fallopian tubes. That turns out, this story.
Yeah. Human history tells us.
Right. On kind of a sadder note, on a much sadder note, this is why there are ectopic pregnancies. Mm. When babies don't implant into a uterus, they implant into a fallopian tube. That's an ectopic pregnancy. So if you've heard that term thrown around before, it's because the egg and the sperm meet in the fallopian tube, not in the uterus.
That makes sense. All right.
Which seems like a weird thing, given evolution, but I don't have time to get into
that. Yeah. So, well, yeah, this isn't... an episode on
fetal development.
Yeah.
Yes. It just seems like an important starting point to understand. So, okay. So, Olivia, this sperm and egg coming together, new DNA result, Olivia. We're naming her Olivia because I tried to do this with no example and it didn't go up. Okay. So, along the way, when Olivia is moving from the fallopian tube to the uterus, she gets bigger. She gets called a lot of other fancy names that I'm not going to get into. They're all like subsets of zygote. We don't need to get into it.
How many more cells get added? Like, you go from 2 to 3 cells, and now there's
2 to 4.
Oh, okay.
Because you're splitting, right?
That's right.
Wow.
Sorry.
No.
Junior high chemist or, biology teacher, whatever. Sorry. I don't even remember who that person was.
I don't know that you got taught this in biology either. This is, like, the cool side of science that I feel like gets left out a lot of the time.
Actually, come to think of it, I did Dr. Star... AP bio, I absolutely would have learned this.
Okay.
Like, specifically that you have these cells and they're going to replicate. And so you would go from 2 to 4, not
right.
2 to 3. That I should have known. I did well on my AP bio exam.
I believe you. You don't have to. You're allowed to not remember stuff from AP bio. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Okay, so...
You go from 2 to 4. You're not a zygote anymore.
Still are a zygote.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So a zygote is not just when you have a fertilized egg. Mm-hmm. A zygote is actually a stage of development that lasts until Olivia is about 5 days old. Oh, so that's okay. That length of that whole journey from mm-hmm. the fallopian tube into the uterus if everything is healthy and typical. Then Olivia implants into the uterus, mm-hmm. meaning like attaches to the uterine lining at that point, which is about 5 days after Olivia's been conceived. Olivia starts actually implanting into the uterine lining, and in that whole process takes like another 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. So like half the time that Olivia has been in existence has been working on implantation. After implantation is when we start to get toward the next gestational age. Mm-hmm. And this is really important for later, so bear with me. When Olivia is 9 or 10 days old, she's starting her first arts and craft project with her mom, whom I've named Emma because that's the second most popular name in the U.S. right now. So she and her mom have started building a placenta.
Oh,
what do you know about placentas?
It is an organ, mm-hmm. a temporary one.
Yeah,
that,
the only temporary one, or the only one that's designed to be temporary, to be clear.
That someone who is going to have a baby grows, and then it feeds the baby. Mm-hmm. It transfers blood and oxygen and food from the pregnant person to the baby.
Yep. We're going to get into all that more later, but you did it.
Gold star for me.
Very much so. You're recovering from the AP bio
thing
now, aren't
right.
you? There you go. That's good. So placentas are absolutely incredible. We could do a whole episode just on placentas. We don't have to do that today. But along with the placenta, the uterine lining of the parent starts to develop around Olivia. And this becomes a sac that becomes the amniotic sac.
Hmm.
Do you remember what the amniotic sac is?
Stuff that the fetus wiggles around in?
It's like a big bubble that the fetus is in, embryo, and at this point the zygote. And what it is your water. So when people talk about, like, quote-unquote, my water broke, what they mean is the amniotic sac broke.
Okay.
So this amniotic sac that's so important later, often in every single TV episode ever about pregnancy where somebody's water breaks, that's the amniotic sac. So that's starting like 9 or 10 days after implantation. At that point when the amniotic sac is formed, so now we're at 12 days, Olivia has now become a human embryo.
Okay.
So she grew up and graduated into the next stage of fetal development. So Olivia's growing wildly. By her 8th week since conception, she has grown all the structures her body's going to have, and she's just working on developing them. At that point, she has now graduated in terminology to becoming a human fetus. All
right.
So once you have all of the organ systems you're going to have, you just haven't, like, developed them all the way, you are now a fetus. Hmm. So then she grows for another 30 weeks. Do you notice how it's, like, days and then weeks, and now we're just into, like, there's the rest of pregnancy for you, and then she's born.
Yeah.
And at that point, she graduates to becoming a human newborn.
Mm-hmm.
Now, earlier you were, like, kind of waffling on what a newborn was, like, 6 weeks, 8 weeks? Yeah, and everybody's like that. So unlike these prior terms, which have, like, very strict embryological boundaries on what can and cannot be called a certain thing, newborns, we have no idea. Maybe it's birth to 2 months, maybe it's birth to 3 months, maybe it's birth to 4 weeks. We don't know. Somewhere in there. After that point, she becomes a human infant until her first birthday.
Oh. Well, who decides?
I don't really know. Like, embryologists decide the zygote fetus embryo thing.
Like, American Pediatric Association, are you failing us? Like, we need a number.
To be fair, they have other problems than just how to define newborn.
I suppose. They've got
stuff going on.
I suppose if care... like, usually these definitions are tied to something. Like, the kind of care that you receive, if there's no difference between 6 weeks and 8 weeks, then fuzzy definitions are fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And apparently, in a cellular level, there's just not really that many differences. So, so basically, that's how we go from zygote to embryo to fetus to newborn to infant. Any questions about the 5 stages of human?
No.
No questions at all. I successfully covered all of human fetal development. Okay.
Everything.
That's lovely.
Actually, no, I have so many questions. Like, why no kneecaps?
I know, right? That's like the grossest thing about babies to me. Yeah. I'm really disturbed by the fact that babies do not have kneecaps.
Yeah, for the uninitiated, babies are born without kneecaps, and then they grow them.
Like 7. It's, like, late in life.
Years old?
Yeah.
It can't be that late.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, they start developing the cartilage, but they don't technically have kneecaps until... So, if you haven't heard me gripe about this before, this is, like, the single most disgusting fact about the human body, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that we don't have kneecaps until we're 7.
Listener, if you have a more disgusting fact about the human body, I'm here for it.
I will also say, I have a pretty different boundary of what's disgusting than a lot of people, but that grosses me out. Okay, so, all this, I'm glad you don't have any questions. I had a question.
Tell me everything.
What the heck is Olivia eating this whole time?
Yeah, well, so I figured you were going to cover this.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to go too far out of order on you. But yeah, like, when Olivia is traveling from the fallopian tube to the uterus, does she need sustenance? And if so, is she getting it from the... I almost said the air. There's not air in there, right? Like, there's not air in there.
Presumably, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she, like, while she's traveling, does she need sustenance? I imagine at the point that she's implanting, you know, she's got access to something, but then it, like, she's not eating her way through the uterine wall.
Like, something from Alien.
What is going on? Yeah. All right. Let's get into it.
Yes. So this is why, I hope you understand now, why I've taken you on this tour through fetal development is... There is a lot of talk in today's society about how babies are fed, particularly infants and newborns. Mm-hmm. But what about prenatally?
Mm-hmm.
What on earth is Olivia, our hypothetical little zygote, eating?
I
want to know. I'm so excited to tell you because this made me so happy to learn this. Okay, so as best I can understand, let's start with zygote Olivia. Zygote Olivia is not eating anything external. She's subsisting entirely off the energy present in her cells.
Okay, so it came with her from her parent cells.
Precisely, which is part of why taking prenatal vitamins is something that's suggested you do for a really long time before you actually try to conceive. And this is true for women in particular, but also men should be taking vitamins if they are looking to try to conceive anytime soon. The idea being that if your cells are healthier, then the zygote will have more energy to use to make it to the next stage where they get their next form of feeding.
Is this test trust it? Like, is there science backing up? Like, I feel like I've seen something about men, like, the sperm quality is affected by the person giving sperm.
Yeah, by diet, by health, by all sorts of things. Yeah, okay. Definitely. But I don't know that there's been a study looking at, like, exactly how diet impacts the health of zygote through sperm. Yeah. I'm not sure that there is something on that.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
When we become biologists, this is our
study. There we go. Okay. So whatever's in there, mm-hmm. especially in the ovum, because that's the much bigger of the two cells, right? Mm. The ovum and the sperm, the egg is a lot bigger than the sperm is, and it's got all the, like, cell structures. Mm. You didn't know that? This is so exciting to share with you.
Do you know why I know that?
Why?
Because of the movie Look Who's Talking.
I haven't seen it. Okay. I haven't even seen Alien. I just made that reference earlier with that, actually.
You knew. Mm-hmm. No, so in the opening credits for the movie Look Who's Talking, I don't remember if it was the original or the sequel, but you see sperm going on a journey, mm-hmm. and then they meet an egg and, mm-hmm. like, burrow into it, mm-hmm. and the one who gets in first wins, obviously, mm-hmm. And all the other sperm don't win. Like, it shields itself after that. Mm-hmm. Technical term.
No, but that's actually accurate. Good job.
Yeah. But the egg in this video, I want to say it was like a microscope or something, but I really mm-hmm. don't think it was. I think that whoever made the movie mm-hmm. had that animated.
Okay.
Which is,
that makes sense. I don't
know, somehow better.
Okay, yeah, that anyway. Makes sense. No, but the egg is bigger than the sperm, yeah. like a lot yes. bigger. The sperm are pretty much carrying just genetic material. Whereas the egg is carrying, like, all the stuff that a cell needs to survive, like mitochondria there and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh. Mitochondria is honestly the only one I can remember. Hmm. But, yeah. So that's why, like...
The zygote doesn't need a source of food because the zygote is created with a source of food.
Right.
Okay.
Precisely.
All right.
So then the zygote is moving into the uterus and then implants around age 9 or 10, as you remember. So... Zygote Olivia just graduated to be called Embryo Olivia because she implanted and started building a placenta and started seeing an amniotic sac built around her. Olivia doesn't build the amniotic sac. Olivia's parent does. But in that amniotic sac, that's coming from the uterine lining. And that's really important for a minute here. I want to stop and talk about uterine lining. Okay. So Jennifer, what do you know about uterine lining?
It's shed once a month.
If you're not pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
And if you're menstruating.
Yes, also that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you've heard of endometriosis before, what that's referring to is endometria, which is that uterine lining. So let's assume that things are going well in this particular circumstance. That endometria, that uterine lining, is creating an amniotic sac, but it's also providing all the nutrients that the embryo needs. Hmm. And the way it's doing this is through something called womb milk.
Womb milk.
Also called... secretions in the glands of the uterine lining that produce glucose. But, you know, it's easier to say womb milk. So what this is...
That's debatable.
Okay, all right, fair. So these glands in the uterine lining are providing embryo Olivia with glucose, which is sugar, right? Like, mm-hmm. the thing you need for energy is coming through the uterine lining, which mm-hmm. is wild and cool, and I did not know before. Like, yeah. this is amazing to me. This is really neat. And I've been in the birth world for a while, and I had not come across this particular fact. So those secretions that are really high in glucose give the at this point, embryo and fetus a lot of energy. Researchers are looking into right now whether parental diet affects that. Like, if you take prenatal vitamins, or if you eat a lot of sugar or things like that, does your glucose get better, or is there more of it, or things like that. So there's a lot of research being done, like, right now in this area, and in the show notes you'll be able to find a couple of public facing articles that the researchers have written about this stuff, so you can learn more about it if you're curious. But the moral of this story is that from implantation to about 8 to 12 weeks, embryo fetus Olivia is eating this womb milk. That's how she's sustaining herself. Mm-hmm. So then at 8 to 12 weeks, the placenta, remember that first Arts and Crafts project?
Sorry.
Yeah,
Now that she's an embryo, does she have a mouth?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where the womb milk is coming in?
No.
Oh.
So the...
Or is it still through the connection? Like,
yeah.
There's a placenta at this point.
Yeah. So Olivia will not use her mouth to eat food until she is born.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
everything until then is coming through either, like, proximity, I guess, is one way to put it. But, like, yeah. through that, like, the placenta creates the umbilical cord mm-hmm. between, well, so Olivia and her parent create this umbilical cord. Mm-hmm. And everything's coming through there. But what my understanding is that while you're waiting for the placenta to develop, that is also the way that food is getting into Olivia. I'm not entirely clear on that. So we may have to contact an embryologist and actually figure that part of it out.
Okay.
So if you're an embryologist or you know an embryologist who can tell us exactly the method by which Olivia receives womb milk,
yeah,
we would like to know. Because my understanding is that it's just through the umbilical cord.
But you have more information about the next step.
I do, which has to do with the placenta, as yeah. you just brought up. So around 8 to 12 weeks is when the womb milk stops being produced, and that's because the placenta starts receiving maternal blood.
Okay.
So when the placenta can receive maternal blood, that's when it can start taking nutrients from the maternal blood and putting them into the umbilical, well, like, putting them through the umbilical cord into, at this point, fetus Olivia.
Yeah. So now my next curiosity is, this is the point at which a lot of medications have warnings on them, like, do not take this because it will transfer
across the placenta.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is part of it. But there are also medications that are not safe to take in pregnancy even before this stage because of what they do to the uterine lining.
Oh, okay.
And if the uterine lining is the thing that's both housing the embryo / zygote mm-hmm. and creating the safe space for the embryo and zygote and feeding the embryo zygote, then that's pretty important.
Yeah.
So, sure. Yeah. So placenta, things crossing the placenta becomes a problem around 8 to 12 weeks when okay. the placenta actually starts doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Until then, it's just been a really cool, like, project that Olivia is working on
okay.
with her mom, whom I've named Emma.
Yes.
But after that point, then it starts becoming really functional mm-hmm. in that it's bringing glucose, once again, and mm-hmm. oxygen and other nutrients to Olivia through the placenta and then through the umbilical cord. So the glucose secretions in the uterine lining, that womb milk, dries up, doesn't come back. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Really cool. So that's what Olivia's eating then at that point.
Yeah.
Is stuff through her belly button that her mom ate that got digested by her body and put into her bloodstream and transferred across the placenta through an umbilical cord to her.
All right.
Pretty wild.
Yeah.
So then this system of the placenta and the maternal blood providing all of the nutrients the baby needs goes on for a long time. As people who have been pregnant for 39 weeks will tell you, it goes on forever. Mm-hmm. And then Olivia graduates to the status of newborn mm-hmm. by getting born.
Yeah.
So then we get into feeding infants. So eventually the baby gets born, and we're going to do a little bit more on fetal development at this point, which is now infantile development, mm-hmm. I guess. But there's something else that's been going on at the same time. So remember Olivia's mom, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
So if everything's normal and healthy, the parent who's pregnant is getting ready to feed their newborn mm-hmm. from, like, week 17 on.
Mm.
So people can lactate as early as 17 weeks pregnant, and that's normal. That's mm-hmm. not, like, outside the realm of normal. So toward the end of pregnancy, Emma might even start to notice, like, milk coming out of her breasts when she doesn't mean for it to. And that early milk is usually really thick, kind of yellow. That's called colostrum. It's incredibly nutrient dense. It's, like, massively nutrient dense. It's amazing. And that's because Olivia gets born and Olivia's stomach is really, really teeny tiny. Do you know how small a newborn's stomach is?
Oh gosh, was it like a thimble or something?
Yeah, it's at birth the size of a toy marble.
Yeah.
Is the measure that I've heard before. And by day 10, it grows to the size of a ping pong ball.
It's a lot. It's a lot of growth.
It's a lot of growth, but also, like, a ping pong ball is like
still not
a shot, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, it's not that much. So a lot of times when parents first start to feed human milk to a baby, they're like, oh gosh, this can't possibly be enough. Because we're thinking about, like, adult portion sizes, right? Or even, like, a toddler eats way more than that. And that's because babies' stomachs are so small when they're born, and then they get bigger. And it's amazing.
Yeah, and that's why they also need to eat all the time.
Constantly, yeah. So how much milk do you think a newborn needs in their first full day of life with that thimble-sized, marble-sized stomach?
Oh, gosh.
That's okay.
Yeah, I feel like I'm being tested on something that was the most relevant, important thing to me mm-hmm. for a very short and exhausted period of time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But, yeah.
Well, I don't want it to feel like that because this is not a test.
A couple ounces?
It's 1 ounce.
Oh, just one.
That whole first day. All they need is 1 ounce, right? Like, that's so little. And it's okay. And colostrum is so nutrient dense that that 1 ounce is going to be okay for them for the whole time.
Yeah.
Then by day 4 or 5, we usually expect to see somebody's milk come in, meaning that that milk turns from being, like, really,
like, concentrated?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Really concentrated to being waterier, and that's okay, because at the same time, Olivia's stomach is growing to be huge, right?
So, is it more energy intensive to create colostrum than regular milk?
I have not seen anything on that, and okay. I think whatever study was done on that would have some problems with complicating factors right off the top of my head, because you produce colostrum when you're pregnant and when you're, like, in labor and delivery and just gave birth, so measuring exhaustion or fatigue is probably not, like, well, it'd be hard to separate that out, you know?
So, I don't know if you know anything about how people found out how many calories are in things.
Yeah.
Like, they burn, so, you know, like, how much does burning this thing, you know, whatever, this food item, raise the temperature of some volume of water, I think? Oh my gosh, it's a good thing I'm not giving a podcast on this topic. This podcast is not about calories. Mm-hmm. This podcast is about other things. But yeah, in theory, someone could take the average of, you know, several people's colostrum and then breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be impossible.
To figure out?
Yeah.
No, someone might have done it.
Oh, okay.
I just can't speak to it.
That's fine.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So all that is happening, and that's a huge change, right? Like, everything about this is a huge change. So for the first time, Olivia's having to digest her own food, right? Like, this whole time, it's been pre-digested. The womb milk was just straight glucose. Like, it was ready for use. The stuff that was coming through the umbilical cord, all the oxygen and nutrients, that was pre-made by Emma, right? So, like, all of a sudden, Olivia has to digest. But also, if you've ever been a lactating parent, that's a huge change for the parent, too, to go from, like, making food for your kid automatically to, oh gosh, this actually requires a lot more intentionality. There's a really great meme with an ultrasound picture, and it's like, the last time my kid ate what I fed them without complaining. I think that's very, very relevant to
the setup. Yeah, it gets even more relevant
as we go. Yeah. So that brings us to then, we've got newborn Olivia. And there are a couple of ways that newborn Olivia can get nutrients, which are?
Breast milk and formula?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So these are the big two, right? Human milk and formula. Okay. So Jennifer, tell me 3 things you know about human milk.
It's got a lot of calories and nutrients, and there's some, like, immune protections for the first 6 months of a kid's life, but after that it gets a little bit murky.
Well, so we know that there are definitely great benefits for the first 6 months, and then after that we still see benefits, which is amazing. So this is why the World Health Organization actually recommends breastfeeding up to 2 years of age and beyond, because the immuno benefits in particular of breast milk just keep going. So human milk has everything a baby needs nutritionally for the first, until their first birthday. So if they only ate that until their first birthday, they'd be okay. A lot of times they don't, because they, like, are starting to be able to steal food off parents' plates and things like that, right? And because it can be a lot easier to not be exclusively nursing or pumping until, you know, somebody's one. But the benefits nutritionally are everything that they need until they turn about one.
That, of course, assume, like everything we have done up till this point, it assumes everything's going right.
Yeah, like I said, everything is typical and healthy.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. So if the milk is coming from someone who lives with the baby, the immunological benefits are incredible. Okay. So what I mean by this is, if Olivia gets sick and Emma, who's living with her, kisses her forehead because she sees that her baby's crying and things are rough for the baby right now, Emma's body will respond to Olivia's temperature on her lips, and any germs that Emma contracts from kissing Olivia, 20 minutes later, her milk will change. Her milk will have a specialized cocktail of antibodies just for Olivia's illness.
That's amazing.
And that's true even if it's not your kid.
Yeah.
Biologically.
Yeah.
So if you have, like, a friend's kid that you're babysitting and they're sick and you come into contact with them through some intimate emotion, like kissing, right? Or even if you have your hand to their forehead for a very long time or something like that. milk will change. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. 20 minutes.
I mean, that's what made wet nurses so effective, right?
Well, how do you mean?
Like, a wet nurse was somebody who's supposed to feed babies, mm-hmm. but if it wasn't useful or effective for making healthy babies, mm-hmm. or, you know, turning babies into healthy children, mm-hmm. then no one would have kept up the practice of mm-hmm. wet nursing.
Yeah, so the point being that, like, this is amazing. Like, these immunological benefits are huge, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And so that's something that people highlight a lot with human milk that has been in the news a lot recently because of COVID in particular. Mm. So we've seen studies that if a parent has COVID and is lactating, their milk will have antibodies to COVID. If a parent gets a vaccine, their milk might have some antibodies mm-hmm. to COVID for some amount of time as well. So, like, even just getting vaccinated can provide your kid with mm-hmm. a level of protection, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Also, I want to highlight that, like, these immunological benefits are true whether Olivia's a few weeks old or several years old.
Oh.
So, like, a yeah. five-year-old, a body, like, a human body will still respond to a five-year-old's illness the same way and create milk specifically for that five-year-old mm-hmm. if that's what's required or needed at that point.
All right.
Yeah. So that's a little bit about the benefits that you listed of human milk, which are mm-hmm. very cool and impressive. We're going to get to the downsides in a minute, so don't worry. But three other things that I think are really fascinating about human milk that I had to say, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to list them now.
Okay.
And if you want to respond to them, you can. And if not, then I will just have had the pleasure of listing them. So first of all, human milk comes from the bloodstream. I don't think people, you're just, like, staring yeah. at me wildly
no,
right now.
No, yeah, I, like, a memory is rattling around in the back of my brain. Yeah.
That okay. you learned this at some point. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some people think it comes from the stomach or something like this, but it actually comes from the bloodstream. And that is amazing. Like, that, there's, okay, I'm not going to get into it, but there's so many cool things that happen because of that.
Yeah.
Second cool thing I want to bring up about human milk. Human males can lactate.
Mm-hmm.
They're just incredibly inefficient at it.
Mm-hmm.
So the mammary glands, which are the glands that actually, like, create, produce, and expel human milk, just never develop during puberty for males, whereas they do for females generally. Again, if everything is typical and healthy. The third interesting thing that I want to say about human milk is that mammary glands are actually modified sweat glands. So the
gross.
Same way, I know, right? So the same way that you produce sweat and then push it out of your body,
mm-hmm.
that's how milk works. It gets created and then pushed out of modified sweat glands.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool how the body just, like, reuses a structure that worked somewhere else. And yeah. Yeah. So those are some awesome things. But let's think about the not awesome things about human milk. In particular, like, why it's not always feasible to feed babies human milk. So some stats on this before we start getting into why. The CDC does a breastfeeding report card every year or every couple of years. But the most recent one they have is 2020. So, and that uses data from 2017. So I really don't know what to tell you about the data.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is that in 2017, while 84% of infants in the United States breastfed at some point, at 6 months old, only 58% were still breastfeeding.
Hmm.
And at a year old, only 35% were still breastfeeding.
What constitutes breastfeeding? Like, being fed once a day? Being fed
at all.
Exclusively? Oh, okay.
Yep.
So at any number of times a day,
yep.
from only eating breast milk to a snack.
Yep. Exactly.
Okay.
Like a once a day thing or like an 8 to 10 times a day
yeah.
thing, which is what we would expect of a newborn, right?
Yeah.
So there's this huge drop off that we see, particularly in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and in some other countries like the U.S. where this is just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we think that is?
I imagine people have to go to work.
Yeah. And workplaces in the U.S. are incredibly unsupportive of lactation.
Mm-hmm.
So there are laws now that say that your work has to give you time and a place to mm-hmm. pump if
a
you want to pump.
Other than the bathroom.
That is not the bathroom. Mm-hmm. I was just going to follow it up with that. Yes.
Yeah.
It cannot be the bathroom. They cannot make you prepare your child's food in a toilet stall.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
That's something.
Yep. So, but that just because there's a place to pump does not mean that
there's a fridge to store it in.
Yep.
There's
not coworkers who
yeah.
will pass you up for promotion
yeah.
or make rude comments about how you get so many more breaks now because you're
yeah.
lactating kind of a thing.
And I mean, I remember pumping and I remember stress and dehydration
yep.
were the two things that were like sure to dry up my milk.
Yeah. And there's actually a third one.
Ooh, tell me.
Which is not being by your baby.
Oh, yeah.
And workplaces, even those that are really supportive of pumping,
mm-hmm.
are very reticent to actually let you bring your baby to the office.
Mm-hmm.
But if we wanted to see an increase in the ease of breastfeeding, that's what would happen,
mm-hmm.
I think, honestly. So,
yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate for the people who want to be able to breastfeed or to feed their child milk, you know, mm-hmm. like human milk, all of the things standing in the way.
Yeah. So one of those, in addition to that, is education. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, we thought that human milk was terrible for babies, mm-hmm. and you really should be giving them other stuff instead. It wasn't until science got way better at things like looking at caloric density and, mm-hmm. wow, look at all these nutrients kind of a thing, that we realized how good human milk is for babies. But a lot of the education that has followed from that has been really targeted toward upper and middle class moms, mm-hmm. who are white and who are fairly educated and who have the, like, income to be able to go to some meeting in the middle of a Tuesday every week, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so the benefits of human milk are something that, like, we haven't even educated mm-hmm. our whole society about. Like, that is information that's really reserved for the elite in some ways. So that's one reason why people don't have access to a place to pump at work. Mm-hmm. And people don't have access to the information that actually human milk is a really cool and awesome thing. And it's not like we thought it was, mm-hmm. you know, in my grandparents' generation where it was like, don't do that. Another reason is because there's a lack of support. So even if you want to feed your kid human milk, that doesn't mean that you have the friends and family or the financial ability to buy the things that you need or things like that. That would make it possible. Mm-hmm. And another one that I, well, another couple that I want to bring up have okay. to do with the health of the parent who's doing the feeding, because that's a really, really big deal, especially okay. to me. So there are some different syndromes people can have, like DIMER, mm-hmm. that actually mean that feeding your child is a horrible experience. Like, it hurts and it's painful and it comes with a huge bout of depression from the hormones that are released during that process, things like that. There are other ways that this can be awful for the parent as well, like pain, repeat mm-hmm. infections of the breast, like mastitis or things like that. And for all those reasons, it can just be awful. Plus, mm-hmm. you're getting up most of the time all through the night if you're exclusively breastfeeding, especially. And so there's a lot of reasons why people would choose not to feed their kid human milk that are really important for us to consider, like, I think.
So some of those things sound, I'm definitely not the expert here, but some of those things sound treatable. Mm-hmm. Like mastitis in particular, I know, is treatable. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is another one of those things that cuts across, like, racial and class lines where some, you know, some people who have access to better health care, you know, health insurance, hospitals nearby or doctors nearby, are going to go get treated for those conditions
yeah.
and then be able to continue feeding. And the people who don't have access to the medical care are just going to stop feeding
yeah.
because it's not worth the trouble.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think there's also, like, if mastitis requires a round of antibiotics, okay, you got to go do that. The guidelines for mastitis just changed on how we treat mastitis, like, a couple months ago. Okay. Because of some new research that came out. But how long do you think it's going to take for that research to get put into practice?
Yeah.
And who's going to put it into practice? The doctors who are paid more and have the time and the money to go to the fancy seminars where they learn the research, right? Or who mm-hmm. have the time at their practice to update themselves on what studies have come out recently, like, that kind of thing. So even, like, how good doctors are at treating mastitis mm-hmm. is going to vary across how good your healthcare is. So with that in mind, though, I do want to highlight, even if you have a really great health insurance plan, if you get mastitis every other month, every month, and you're
still
miserable,
may not feel worth it.
Yeah. And, well, it probably isn't at that point, right? Like,
yeah.
that idea, it's really important for me to highlight that even with all the incredible things that are happening with human milk, there are things happening with the person who's producing it that are even more important mm-hmm. sometimes. And that's why parents need to make the choice that's best for them. Mm-hmm. And that's why so many parents can make different choices. What makes me really sad is when we see people who are making choices because of a lack of support, mm-hmm. because of a lack of access to good health care, because of a lack of access to education. Those are societal level problems, mm-hmm. right? That's a societal thing that's influencing your individual decision in a negative way that, you know, if I could fix it all, I would.
Yeah, that makes sense. But if all of those things were possible, we would still have people who are choosing not breast milk or not human milk.
Yeah, understandably.
And luckily we have an option.
We do. Well, we have a couple options, actually.
All right.
The first one, which we're only going to spend like two sentences on, is donor milk.
Mm-hmm.
And donor milk is human milk that comes from another person for your baby. And this can be something that goes through a really rigorous testing procedure and sterilization procedure through something like a milk bank. This can also be peer-to-peer milk sharing. There's a whole lot of stuff just about donor milk that we could get into and we won't. But know that it's an option and it's a thing that's out there. The other way that you were thinking of, though, Jennifer, is formula.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you know about formula.
You would think I would know a lot about formula because we used formula for I guess, about 6 months, somewhere in there. Formula is pretty rigorously tested, all of it. And so...
In the U.S.
In the U.S. And so the stuff that you get with the, like, Target or Costco label on it is going to be the same level of safety as the stuff you get with the Gerber logo on it. Sometimes better, depending on the brand and the kind of testing they do. I remember spending a lot of time on a website that looked at heavy metals in formula and children's food. And coming away with the conclusion that, like, Kirkland brand formula was, like, in the top 10% of formulas. And it was also significantly cheaper than a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, what a savings. I need to become a Costco member now.
There you go. So free advertisement for Costco. Your formula rocks. Thank you. So there are a couple other things that I want to introduce people to about formula in case they've never interacted with formula before. There are three types of formula. It comes in a powder or in a concentrate or in like a bottle ready to drink. And the powder is what most people use because it's the cheapest. And it also requires the most preparation.
It stores better too.
It stores better too. Yeah, it's shelf stable for a while.
Yeah.
Yep. No. Yes. But it does go bad, which is also on my list of things about formula. And it goes bad for the same reason that something in your pantry would go bad. Like, you worry about bacteria getting in there, and that becomes a problem for reasons we're going to go into in a few minutes. In the U.S., the FDA sets requirements for what ingredients need to be included in infant formula, and there are a lot of them. Different things like how much protein, how much carbohydrate, how much of a certain vitamin, all that is regulated by the FDA. So what you were saying before about like safety testing standards, the very base level is like what needs to go into it. And then the extra level is like what needs to not go into it, which is what you were referring to before. So the history of formula is something that could be its own episode, but we are not a history show, so we will not be doing that episode. However, the idea of feeding kids something other than human milk from their parent has a really long history. So you had alluded to earlier, Jennifer, wet nurses. And in the U.S. especially, this was often a job that enslaved women were forced to take on. And their own children would be taken from them or made to starve while the human milk was given to the enslavers' children because human milk was seen as so precious and so important. And if you want to learn more about that history of lactation and enslavement in the U.S., you should definitely look it up. There are some great resources out there, and we will link to those in the show notes. But in case human milk wasn't an option, people were looking into stuff like cow's milk, sheep's milk, goat's milk. I looked up buffalo milk after our cheese episode, thinking like maybe, and I didn't really get a whole lot of hits. But anyway, it didn't seem to work very well. So in 1838, a German scientist whose name was Johann Franz Simon wrote up a chemical analysis of cow's milk, and he compared it to human milk. And he found out that cow's milk has more protein and fewer carbohydrates than human milk. So that's why it was not working very well for babies. Then there's this article from the Contemporary Pediatrics that was really interesting. And I'm going to ask you, Jennifer, could you read the part of it that I put into your episode outline, please?
I would love to. Empirically, physicians began to recommend that water, sugar, and cream be added to cow's milk to render it more digestible and closer to human milk. By 1860, a German chemist, Justus von Liebig, developed the first commercial baby food, a powdered formula made from wheat flour, cow's milk, malt flour, and potassium bicarbonate.
So just pause. Does that sound appealing to you at all?
I just learned that malt is a flour. I'm learning so much in this. All right. No, that sounds disgusting. The formula, continuing reading. The formula, which was added to heated cow's milk, soon became popular in Europe. Liebig's soluble infant food was the first commercial baby food in the U.S., selling in groceries for $1 a bottle in 1869. Wow, that sounds like a lot of money.
Right?
Wow.
Okay. In 1869? Yeah.
Continuing. In the 1870s, Nestle's infant food made with malt, cow's milk, sugar, and wheat flour became available in the U.S., selling for 50 cents a bottle. In contrast to Liebig's food, Nestle's formula was diluted with water only, requiring no cow's milk to prepare, and thus was the first complete artificial formula available in this country.
So I don't know about you, but that was earlier than I thought formula would have gotten invented.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was invented, but when was it then available? Like, or rather, when was it in mass use?
Okay, so this, I think, really came about in, like, the mid-1900s, where people were being told. Yeah, because that was when it was, like, human milk is bad, human milk is disgusting, human milk is not good for your kid, you should really be using other stuff, like evaporated milk instead. And a part of this seems to be that pediatricians decided to get involved. Like, pediatricians were like, no, Nestle, is it Nestle or Nestle? I will never know how to say it because of the Friends episode. That's... I don't know the right way to say it.
I'm pretty sure it's Nestle.
Nestle? Okay, yeah, all right.
Phoebe was like...
Nestle Toulouse, and I'll never know how to say it correctly. Yeah. Nestle.
Nestle Toulouse.
That was it, yep.
Yeah, but no, I think it's Nestle. I mean...
All right, but they really pushed this in the U.S. in particular, or at least that's what I was reading about. Mm-hmm. And so when pediatricians started wanting to get involved, evaporated milk became a big deal. Formula scientists started adding stuff to make formula more like human milk, like... You know, instead of malt, flour, and things like that, cod liver oil. And things got wild. So much so that in 1980, Congress passed the Infant Formula Act of 1980, which one PubMed article daringly called, quote, one of the most specific and detailed acts ever passed by Congress, end quote. Which I feel like that's, like, quite a claim to make.
Yeah.
But having not read it in its entirety, to be honest, I can't tell you whether that's true.
The article.
The act.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, me neither.
The article went on to describe the bill by saying, quote, it establishes minimum nutrient requirements, defines adulteration, provides for establishing nutrient and quality control procedures, prescribes recall procedures, and specifies inspection requirements, end quote. So that brings us to 2022. It doesn't really. A lot of other stuff happens that you can read about if you want to, but this isn't a show about the history of stuff. This is a show about the fascinating aspects of ordinary everyday life, and ordinary everyday life got way harder for formula feeding parents this past year. So, Jennifer, tell us about the formula shortage.
So there's a formula shortage. It's the great formula shortage of 2021-22. Did it start in 2020 or did it start in 2020?
It started in 2022, I think.
Oh, that late.
Feels like it's been forever, hasn't it?
It does, yeah. Time has a blending thing going on. Okay, so, yeah, sometime, who can say when, around 2020, things got a little weird, and then in 2021, a lot of the effects of that became, like, very tangible in the sense that products were not available. I keep hearing about, supply chains.
Yeah, yeah.
Over and over again, supply chains. So the people who make the milk were having some issues making it. I assume part of it is a labor issue. I assume part of it is a manufacturing issue. But the end result was they were not making enough formula to feed all of the children that needed formula right now.
Yeah. And, like, by a lot. At one point in the U.S., the nationwide out-of-stock range for formula was 70%. Like, 70%.
That means 70% of product that should be on shelves is not on shelves.
And typically that number is 10%. Because, you know, stuff is out of stock sometimes. Sure. But this was not stuff was out of stock. This was not, oh, my kid's favorite formula is out, so I guess I'll have to find a backup formula. This was like, there is nothing for me to feed my kid. This was really bad. So there's a couple of reasons why it happened. One, you already pointed to, the global supply chain crisis that started in 2021. I honestly cannot tell you what a supply chain is still. Like,
okay.
It's how things get on our shelves. This That's is what not I understand.
A business podcast.
It's not. nope, I can tell you how breast milk is made, but I cannot tell you how formula gets on shelves through a supply chain. So anyway, that crisis started in 2021 and affected a lot of stuff, not just formula. But 90% of the formula in the U.S. is made by four companies. So there's, like, a monopoly situation going on.
How many of those companies is Nestle?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Yeah. Can you look that up?
Yeah, what are the four companies? Okay. We have Perio Company, Nestle USA, Mead Johnson Nutrition, and Abbott Nutrition.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just be very clear that all of these companies have had situations, shall we say, in the past. Like, actually, I took an egg
Natal. None of them are known for their ethical dealings. They're all known for making products and making money.
Yeah. I took an agnotology class, which is the study of ignorance and how it's created.
Excellent. Wow.
It was awesome. It was a great really fascinating class, mostly because of who I took it with. Okay. But
we need an episode on that.
And oh my gosh, it was so good. But one of the things that was really interesting is we did a whole week on Nestle. Yeah. Okay, we did a whole week on Nestle making formula mm-hmm. to sell on the continent of Africa mm-hmm. and how they'd make it so much worse. Mm-hmm. It was wild. So anyway, of these,
they would make it to save money if the formula was worse so that they could make money. Mm-hmm. So be it.
Yeah. So look this up if you're interested. But basically, the latest sort of scandal that hit one of these companies was in 2022, one of the plants, well, it started in 2021, but mm-hmm. one of the plants had a bacterial contamination that the FDA thought might have been involved in 9 infant deaths. Mm. And so the plant had a voluntary recall, which already meant, like, this is one of 4 companies in the entire U.S. that's creating formula, right? Well, there's more than 4, but like creating 90% of the formula. Mm-hmm. They do a recall, which means that a lot of product is coming off the shelves that was on the shelves. Then the FDA shuts them down. Mm-hmm. And so there's no more product being created. And then there were safety violations reported at the same plant. Mm-hmm. So then they were like really under investigation. And what happened after this was a lot of price gouging, profiteering. The Defense Production Act got called in to fly in formula from other countries that meet the U.S. standards. All this because people did not have what they needed to feed their kids. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly as terrifying as it sounds.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about it. I can't believe we got to that point.
I know. Well, I think part of it, too, is replacement theory of, like, if I don't have a Swiffer, then I can get the knockoff Swiffer.
Yeah.
And if I don't have Honey Nut Cheerios, I can feed myself a banana for breakfast. Mm-hmm. But when you are a child who needs formula, that's it. Like, it's formula or it's human milk. You can't feed cow's milk for the reasons we already talked about. Like, it's just not the right proportion of what a baby needs. And so...
And presumably the kid is getting formula because human milk isn't an option. For whatever we talked about, there's lots of reasons why parents wouldn't give their baby human milk. Lots of very valid reasons. So when people would go online, you know, you can always trust people online for their best opinions and say, well, just give them human milk. It's mm-hmm. like that we're here because this was the better of two options.
Right. And I also want to point out that I really do believe that most kids who are getting fed human milk are also getting fed formula. Mm-hmm. And most kids who are getting fed formula have at some point been fed both formula and human milk. Like, it's not an either or, right? Yeah. These are two tools that can be used together. But even for parents who were having both of those tools, that's a huge shift to go to then all of a sudden expecting the lactating parent to be the one to take this on. Mm-hmm. Of like, you have to up your supply, you have to start pumping at work, you have to whatever. So even for parents who had that option of human milk, that's a huge dramatic shift in life.
And what does it look like to up your supply? Would you say that's, like, easy?
No. For some people, it's impossible. Yeah. And for other people, it's far more possible, but it's a lot of burden. Like, mm-hmm. people often say, like, oh, human milk is free. Like, yay. Mm-hmm. Formula is so expensive. Human milk is only free if you're discounting the labor and intensity that people, women, are putting into pumping mm-hmm. and breastfeeding and things like that, right? And that's a lot of time and energy, both in the physical and mental and emotional sense. So... even for families who had the option of human milk, this was really, really stressful and still continues to be. I want to point out that, like, for some families, this was a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. For kids who could only have certain formulas because of allergies or things like that, mm-hmm. many of those kids got hospitalized. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find an exact number, but I know that there were reports of at least 20 kids who had to get hospitalized because they were starving because parents could not find formula.
Yeah.
And I know this is something where, like, in the height of it, I'd be finding stuff for clients, for friends, like just spending an hour every night before I went to bed, like trying to search all the websites of what's in stock, where can I get something here and ship it to this person. Like, it was really, really bad and it was really, really stressful. Mm-hmm. It still continues to be, but things have gotten a little bit better. Mm-hmm. The main reason for that is that the Sturgis plant that kind of
the one not really started at all.
Yes, yeah. The one that had been shut down reopened after like a lot of finagling with mm-hmm. the FDA and presidents got involved and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And then 12 days later, it flooded and shut back down.
Okay.
and then reopened again after that. And basically what happened is there's a lot of investigations that have opened up this year into formula because of what's been going on. So, for example, the FDA is investigating the FDA for the delays in addressing this to begin with. Like, the bacteria were found in 2021, and nothing got shut down or recalled for a really long time, right? So what happened there? There's a congressional hearing on the formula market.
Oh, great.
Because it might be a monopoly. Like, well, it might... I
mean, yeah. Yeah. We have for sure an oligopoly.
Right.
But if they're working with each other, if they're price setting together or anything like that.
Yep. And it's something that we all need. Like, our community is way better when there are living kids in it. And if we don't have formula, we drastically reduce the number of families who can have kids. And we put into danger the kids that are already here. So because of that, there's a congressional hearing on the formula market. Pelosi said that there might be indictments. I don't know what that means, and it might have just been, like, a ploy to get political favor, but that's interesting. Yeah. The FDA is investigating itself again through an outside review. ABC News is investigating how a bunch of other plants had the same report of bacterial contamination, but the Sturgis plant was the only one that, like, got in trouble for it. Right? Wild. Yeah. So anyway, all this to say, this is an ongoing and unfolding situation. We're recording this episode in October 2022. Things may have changed since then, and if so, I think we should post an update, because this is really important to the lives of a lot of parents.
Yeah.
So on that really bummer note, I want to turn to the last part of this podcast that I wanted to cover, which is it's important to note that infants can start eating non-human milk, non-formula foods. Generally, pediatricians recommend the introduction of other foods around 4 to 6 months. We're going to get a lot more into this with Jennifer's episode coming up, but there's two myths I want to highlight here. The first is that you should only give a baby a new food every 3 days or 4 days, so you know if they react to something, what they react to. Research doesn't bear this out. Babies can develop allergies anytime, so if you feed them for 4 days and they develop an allergy on day 7, that's really normal, so it's not actually going to help you figure out what the allergy is to, and then you're not going to expose them to as many foods. Yeah. So go for it. Just give your kid as many different kinds of food at once as you want.
Yeah, and also... there are a handful of foods that we all know, or, you know, I guess go look at a menu someplace and there will be a list of allergens at the bottom that say, like, food may have been prepared near whatever. Those are the foods that you should be a little bit more careful when introducing everything else. I mean, not zero people are allergic to peas, but not many people are allergic to peas.
We should look
that up. If your child says they're allergic to peas, they're probably lying. So,
good clarification.
Introducing things that are not known allergens, you're probably fine to do those, like, on top of each other.
Likely. Yep. Yeah. And second is on known allergens, or not known allergens, but more likely allergens. So the myth with this is don't give baby any of those until they turn one. And research has actually indicated that countries in which babies are really likely to have things like nut products early on in life actually have lower rates of those allergies overall. So peanut butter is something you should be really careful about still, right? Like, don't, it doesn't take away the choking risk or things like that, but allergen food is something that we've done a lot more research on in the last couple of decades, and we're getting way more confident and comfortable in what we say is okay for kids to have and isn't okay for kids to have. Jennifer, what's the one food you should never give an infant until they turn one?
Honey.
Yeah.
I know this one.
Why?
I was so excited to be able to give Luke honey after one.
Yeah. Honey's in a lot of stuff, man.
Yeah. Boy, isn't it. I think it has something to do with, like, the bacteria in it, like, but you can't take it out. Like, you can't treat it for bacteria the way you can treat other things for bacteria.
Yep, exactly. So, because that bacteria can go in honey and can stay in honey in ways that it can't in other things, we don't like botulism. Don't give kids honey. Yeah. But that means you have to check, like, bread and graham crackers and all sorts of wild stuff. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
If you're worried about it, or if you accidentally gave your kid under the age of one honey, just call your pediatrician. Botulism is really rare, but they can walk through the signs and symptoms with you. So takeaways. There's a lot of ways to feed kids. A lot of it happens, hopefully, naturally, as long as everything is typical and healthy. And then as soon as choice gets involved, so does a lot of shame and guilt.
No, so, take away the shame and guilt.
Yep.
Don't shame or guilt people that you know. Don't let them shame or guilt you. If they are, send us a message. I would be happy to draft a text or an email to someone who is shaming or guilting you about the way you feed your kid.
There we go. I'm not going to make that offer, but I'll make a different one, which is if you feel like you don't have an option about how to feed your kid, if you feel like you're trapped into a thing, let me know. And I would love to brainstorm with you what other options you have, because if you feel like you don't have options, then you don't. And hopefully we can get you the resources, education, information you need to make the choice that's best for your family. So consider all the things that we covered today. I think so many of them, hopefully all of them, are fascinating. About this really ordinary topic, this really ordinary act of feeding little kids. It's really beautiful what formula can do. And it's really cool how bodies can create human milk. And it's wild how zygotes and embryos and fetuses have this whole system figured out.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. So one thing that I would really encourage you, if you're feeding a kid right now in any gestational age, way to go. Like, you rock. This is not easy. Even the ones that are happening naturally are not easy. If you are not, I challenge you to go applaud someone who is. Like, and so I made these affirmations that I have on my Instagram account, Abby the Sociologist Doula, of just like, way to go feeding your kid kinds of things for all sorts of different feeding conglomeration, whatever that looks like for you. But like, go send those to somebody, or go like cheer somebody on who's trying to figure out how to feed their infant, or go ask someone like, hey, I saw your baby registry. Do you need anything that's that you didn't feel comfortable putting on there, like breast pads or something? Like, is there anything that I can do to support you in that? Because we need a culture where parents feel like they're being rooted for. And we can do that one parent at a time. We can make sure people feel encouraged and supported in feeding their kids, whatever that looks like.
That is beautiful.
Good.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Please listen to the next episode, which is on feeding kids after they start eating real food. Not, you know, because milk's not real. It's pretend.
That's what you took away from this?
Yeah. And yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to support us, you can do so on Patreon, follow us on Instagram, and
hold tight for part two.
Yeah, yes. What's the beautiful thing that we want to end on? Every day, people are providing nourishment in some way to a person that is going to grow up and walk around and
refuse to eat peas.
And what?
And refuse to eat peas.
I was going to say listen to our podcast.
Oh, there we go. That's a good one, too.